Right, so I'm going to talk about the attempts to axiomatize quantum field theory Wick-rotated to Riemannian rather than Lorentzian space-times along the following lines. So the idea is one's trying to define a d-dimensional quantum field theory. And d is the space-time dimension. So the general principle is that one's going to associate to a compact oriented d minus 1 manifold, let's say y, a topological vector space and one's going to associate to a d-dimensional cobordism, let's say x, which I'll write like this, just to save time. That means that we have a picture like this with y naught at one end, y1 at the other end. To that situation, we associate an operator. And two properties are meant to be satisfied. One, that if you concatenate cobordisms, these operators compose. And the other is a sort of tensoring property, that if you put two of these things just side by side, disjoint union, these things tensor, and similarly for the operator. So there are two axioms. Well, obviously this is a pretty meager set of axioms, and the question is, can it possibly encode everything that quantum field theory is meant to contain? And the answer is pretty obviously not, although it gets surprisingly near. One of the things, the most obvious lack in the axioms, which somehow always been clear, is that one somehow wants this space to be constructed locally out of Y. If one could make some axiom or property which characterized the way that locality, one would be in much better shape to be able to recapture the structure of a quantum field theory. Well, let me... I'll come in a moment to what one could actually use the locality property for if one had it. But let me first of all just try to tell you what locality means very crudely. You see, the obvious thing is, suppose you take a Y and you cut it by a codimension 1 manifold Z into Y1 and Y2. So Y is the union of two things like that. Then one would like to say that the vector space associated to Y should somehow be made out of something associated to Y1 and something associated to Y2. So is there some notion like that where it should be somehow joined together along Z? I mean, the simplest hope might be simply that you could make a assign a vector space to each of the two halves, and the things should simply tensor. I mean, after all, for example, if this space, you see, it's certainly true that if you look, say, at the L2 functions on Y, then this is just the Hilbert space direct sum of the L2 functions on the two pieces. So if you were to make some kind of naive Fock space and take the symmetric algebra, the Hilbert space symmetric algebra on this, this would indeed be the Hilbert space tensor product. That's certainly true. But the spaces, the state spaces of quantum field theory unfortunately do not behave in this simple way. Well, actually, of course, it's really rather fortunate that they don't, because physics, if you think about it, would actually be trivial. If this really happened, there would be no transmission of information from one part of Y to the other, and there would really be no physics. So we don't actually want that to happen. So what we want is some more subtle notion which we can, in which we can somehow use Z. Well, so what can one hope to do? One can somehow try, well, so to put it in as physics a language as possible, so to speak, if we enlarge the two pieces, so if we enlarge Y1, so let's call it Y1 plus, by just pushing it a little bit past the boundary, and similarly enlarge Y2, so that the things overlap in a little collar around Z, then in fact we can assign a vector space to each of those two larger things. And essentially what I'm about to convince... Yeah?
Sorry, I didn't mean to... well... anyway, I'm surprised. Why do you want to associate the vector space to these guys? Because in a set finely considered d-manifold, when you go two levels down, these are like manifolds of corners, right? So it would be more natural to think that HY is like a whole space.
Absolutely. Yes. We'll come to that. So let me give you this heuristic thing first of all. To this Y1, which, as has just been pointed out, will actually be a manifold with a corner. Let's just go on for a minute. Y was meant to be a closed manifold, and I sliced it in two by a codimension 1 submanifold. I then took the two halves and I enlarged them a little bit so they overlap in a collar around Z. And I want to say I'm going to associate a vector space then to each of these two things, or at least this is the first approximation. Each of those vector spaces, however, will be modules for an algebra. There'll be modules for an algebra of field operators, which is somehow generated by fields just supported in this little tubular neighborhood of Z. And so we're going to associate some algebra. So this is a first very rough description. We're going to associate some kind of algebra to this interface Z. And these things are going to be modules for it. Think of this as a right module for it, and this as a left module for it. So roughly speaking, we're going to be able to tensor over this algebra, and in that way reconstruct the space. And we can make this as small as we like, but we can't do without any kind of overlap. So I want to explain that, at least in the case of free massive boson theory on an arbitrary curved background. And the case I was actually myself interested in studying, for which it's certainly also true, is the Wessamino-Witten models in two dimensions. So they're not quite free field theories. Before going into any details, so this is an oversimplification of what one has to prove, but there are three kinds of reasons for being interested in this sort of thing. The first is just because of trying to develop an axiomatization of path integrals. And when you start working with just this system and try to build up the traditional theory, then essentially it is a perfectly good definition, and for instance it works amazingly well in, for example, the case of two-dimensional conformal field theory, which is the one I started thinking of. But even there, one knows that these two-dimensional conformal field theories form moduli spaces. One has infinitesimal deformations of them. Now, any physicist will at once assume that any infinitesimal deformation of a theory is given by adding some infinitesimal field term to the Lagrangian. So in the path integral mythology that lies behind all this, there's a sort of assumption that any infinitesimal deformation of a theory is given by a field in the theory. Now, what's a field in the theory? Well, you see, if you're on a manifold X in this axiom system, what would we mean by a field associated to X? Well, it would be something that would change this operator in the following way. We'd cut out a little piece around X. Imagine X, for instance, is a cobordism, actually, from something to something. And we had a point X. We could cut out a little piece around there. Let's call that dx, the piece we cut out. And that would give us something x0. And we'd have then something ux0, which went from hy0 tensor h of the boundary of this little disk going to hy1. And a field operator would be, changing this by a field operator would be choosing something in the vector space associated to the boundary of the little neighborhood of X and inserting it in there, using this as a sort of multiplication. Well, so the question is, does any deformation of the theory come by choosing something, some element in the boundary of a disk, and then one would presumably have to then integrate it over all positions of putting in the little disk or something. Anyway, I don't want to go down that route. I just want to explain that we would like to be able to construct some moduli space of theories. And so we would like to be able to prove a theorem which told us what the infinitesimal deformations of a theory were in a practical way. And in order to do that, you would need to be able to contemplate cutting up cobordisms not just into slices, but into smaller pieces, into little cellular bits. And if you want to be able to cut up into, as it were, fairly standard small pieces, you need to be able to cut down to at least codimension 2. Maybe you need to cut down further, but you certainly need to cut down at least to codimension 2. So the application I'm actually interested in is this question of deforming theories, but I'm not going to talk about that. Now, there's a completely different application, which is relevant this week, I dare say. Stefan Stolz and Peter Teichner are talking this week about their approach to elliptic cohomology and putting in the sort of third tier of data which I'm going to describe for free field theories is one of the essential steps forward that they made in trying to describe a kind of quantum field theory treatment of elliptic cohomology. So pursuing their ideas is one of the motivations also. And of course, the motivation that in a way I started off with was understanding what's called the fusion of representations of loop groups, the Belinda theory. Again, I'll say a tiny bit about that later on, but I'm afraid I'm going to stick mainly just to the abstract development. So let me just make a little remark about, one has to be a little bit more careful about this. This topological vector space shouldn't really be associated to a D minus one dimensional manifold. You see, it wouldn't even make sense, because when you have a cobordism and you want to sew on another cobordism, then you wouldn't get a smooth manifold unless you gave some additional structure. What we really mean by this is really a germ of a D manifold along Y. In other words, you think of Y as sitting inside some larger thing, and you actually give yourself a little neighborhood of it in the D-dimensional thing, and you regard two such neighborhoods as equivalent if they intersect in a neighborhood of Y. In other words, you consider arbitrarily small thickenings of Y. And it's to that that this space HY is meant to be assigned. And of course, if you have the space, if Y means a little ribbon like that, then it's perfectly clear how you combine cobordisms. There's no question of sewing together, no problem of sewing together the smooth structure. But that raises another point which is quite interesting. I'm not necessarily concerned with unitary theories, but unitary theories are important. What does it mean to say that a theory is unitary? Well, a theory is unitary, roughly speaking, if this is a Hilbert space, and in this situation, this operator changes to its adjoint when you reverse the orientation of X. You see, if you have a cobordism from X to Y and you reverse its orientation, you can think of it as a cobordism the other way around. You can ask for the cobordism associated to the reverse thing to be the adjoint operator. That would make sense if this is a Hilbert space. Now, how do you actually axiomatize that this is a Hilbert space? Well, it follows just from the axioms we've already got at these two levels that if we were to reverse the orientation of Y, it follows, supposing Y bar means that with the reverse orientation, then this is canonically isomorphic to the dual vector space. That's true quite independently of unitarity. Unitarity is the property that this is isomorphic to the complex conjugate space of this. So this property is unitarity, just the abstract complex conjugate space. So for a unitary theory, the complex conjugate is isomorphic to the dual, and then the thing is a Hilbert space, and then we have some axioms. Well, we have to be a little bit careful about this. What do we mean? Well, I could talk about exactly what kind of duality I mean, but let's not worry about that just for the moment. What is important here is what this means. You see, if we have a little... if Y really means a little ribbon like this, then what we're really doing is reversing the orientation of the little ribbon. And supposing, you see, this little ribbon is sitting with curvature inside its surrounding. It has a second fundamental form, the Cauchy data for gravity. If we reverse this thing, the Cauchy data for gravity will reverse. So, in fact, you only expect to get... you see, so these two things look different. And you only expect to get a Hilbert space when across Y there is an orientation, that there is a reflection which has Y as fixed points, which reverses obviously the orientation in the D-dimensional manifold, and which preserves enough of the normal structure, the metric or whatever is needed, in order for this space to be defined. You see, what will actually happen is that H of Y, which is, depends on this little germ, will depend on Y, and it will depend usually on a certain number of normal derivatives of the Riemannian metric transversal to Y. Now, of course, one easily calculates that with the standard definitions of free field theory, that you normally expect this to depend on the integral part of d minus 1 over 2 normal derivatives of the metric. So, for instance, if we're talking about two-dimensional theories, this is just zero, and that's saying that in two-dimensional theories, you don't see any normal structure. So you don't see the, when the state space, say in a two-dimensional theory, doesn't see the curvature with which the spatial cut sits inside space-time. But, sorry? Well, I haven't really got to, well, sorry, both, yeah, no, it's the same for both free fermions and free bosons, yes. Because it's just different number of, it's essentially the same problem with a different number of components, analytically. But, see, if D were 4, then this will be 1, and that's sort of, yeah. Well, if D were 4, this would be 1, so you'd expect to see the second fundamental form, the curvature, which is what you, a physicist, I think, would expect. You expect this is free bosons in an arbitrary gravitational background. Well, you expect the gravitational background at any point to have its usual Cauchy data for gravity, which is the metric and the second fundamental form of the metric. On the other hand, it would be very strange, you see, if this were to depend on a larger number of transverse derivatives of the metric, so that you needed to know the acceleration, so to speak, of the Riemannian metric of y in order to construct this space. And that's what you would have to do with the standard free boson theory above dimension 4. I've always thought that's a reason, well, one of the reasons why quantum field theories are so problematic above dimension 4, but certainly the free theories depend on a higher, the state space depends on more derivatives of metric.
Okay, so I just wanted to make sure I understood the context. I think you partly explained that. So you are thinking about a field theory on a fixed background.
Yes. Yeah. I'm definitely not doing quantum gravity. The metric is fixed, but nevertheless it's not flat. Yeah, we're definitely not letting the metric be dynamic.
I'm sorry, where is it in the theory, the standard boson that you use with d-1 derivative for that?
I'll come to that. In fact, why don't I come to that right away? So how do we make a standard free boson? So you see, this is all meant to be based on sort of the concept of a path integral. I mean, we're trying to formalize path integrals, though we don't mention them. So a scalar field theory is meant to be describing some real valued function, phi, a smooth field on x. And that's going to have some action, s of phi, which will be d phi star d phi plus m squared phi star phi. That's the standard action for a massive boson. How do we expect to get this space hy? Well, of course, classically, you have your y sitting inside a little cylinder. You look at the classical solutions of the variational problem for this metric in your little tubular region, and they form a symplectic manifold sigma y which of course will be determined by their value on y and their first derivative. So sigma y in this theory will be, well, you give phi on y, then you give phi dot on y. Well, phi dot is really consists of phi, and it's really, well, I should say, phi restricted to y, and star d phi restricted to y. Phi dot is really star d phi. So this thing is omega naught, the smooth functions on y, plus the smooth d minus 1 forms on y. These things are naturally in duality just by multiplying and integrating on an oriented manifold. So this is a symplectic manifold, and hy should somehow be the quantization of this. So just thinking naively, we expect HY to be the Hilbert space of L2 functions on omega naught of Y. Well, what does that mean? Obviously this is an infinite dimensional vector space, so it's a problem to make an L2 out of it. Now let me just remind you of some formal trivialities. Supposing V is a topological vector space, any topological vector space, and we wanted to find something that we could call L2 of V. Well, you need to make some choices. The easiest way to do is to do a sort of Gaussian space. Supposing we choose Q a positive definite quadratic form, and it's going to be continuous in the topology of V. Well, I just like it to be locally convex and complete. What I have in mind is always something like the C infinity functions on something. So it'll be a nuclear space in all my applications. And using that Q, we can then define a Hilbert space. What we do is we consider some space FQ of V, which, so this is actually a certain space of functions on V, which contains e to the minus half q, that's a Gaussian function, and it contains all polynomials on V, whereby a polynomial, I mean not just any continuous linear form, but something of the form, well, if I think of q as being a bilinear form, also, I won't distinguish in the notation. I can consider things like Q V1V. So if I take a vector V1 in V and take its pairing using this quadratic form, I'll call that a linear function, and sums of products of those things I'll call polynomials. So we make this space of sort of Gaussian things times a polynomial. And then, of course, I think everyone knows by the usual rules of Wick how to put an inner product formally on these things, just using Q. And we can then complete this, and then we'll get a space which is I'll call L2Q of V. Now, of course, you have to remember that once you complete, you can no longer think of the things as functions on V. The convergent sequences in this will not be almost everywhere convergent on V. So, although you started off with actual functions on V, they will no longer be functions on V once you complete. No matter. This is meant to be a linear function depending on V1. That's a map from V.
Okay.
Let's call this function F sub V1 of V. That's what I mean. That's a linear function F sub V1. But it's not just any linear function. It's one of that form. In other words, I'm not allowing the most general kind of polynomial. A sort of tame polynomial. Well, so we can complete that and we get a Hilbert space. Now, in that Hilbert space, you should notice that there's the Gaussian element itself. Let's call that psi sub q. And what I'm doing is, for the moment at least, just giving that norm 1. So in some sense, I haven't really made any serious attempt to normalize the inner product on this Hilbert space. But at any rate, it is a Hilbert space. Well, now we want to apply this construction here. Now, so we want to get a quadratic form. Well, of course, it's obvious what quadratic form to take, because just from the free field theory, we know, you see, we want to get a vector if we, y is the boundary of something x. We know that we want to get a vector psi x in H of y. And if we had another thing, x prime, on this side, we want to get a dual vector on that side. So that tells us what kinds of things ought to be in here. Well, what function do we expect psi of x to be? Well, you see, if you just do the path integral, so to speak, formally, this, the wave function associated to x will be given a function phi on y. What this would be is e to minus s, well, up to a constant, phi classical, where phi classical is the solution of the classical field equation which has boundary value phi there. And of course, this is equal to is the integral over y of phi times d by dn of phi classical. So in other words, all you've got to know is just the normal derivative of the classical solution as you move away from y. This is just integration by parts, gets you from here to here. So this is a nice Gaussian function. We need to know the operator, which I think I'll call a x, which is a map from omega naught of y to omega d minus 1 of y, which tells you the normal derivative of the classical solution with that boundary value, the Dirichlet and Neumann, so to speak, operator. Now, so that's something we'd like to lie in this space. Actually, it's a little bit more subtle and slightly more subtle than that, because what we really want to be able to do, if this were going to be a Hilbert space, so to speak, we want psi x and psi x prime both to lie in it, and the thing we want to be able to integrate is the product. So I want to form this thing using a Q, which is the thing really ax plus ax prime, because we'll get half of these things. And that's often called the Neumann jump operator. You see, we take a function on y, we extend it to a classical solution on both sides. It then will have a jump in its normal derivative as you go across the membrane, and that's the thing you record with this operator Q. And we want to form then a Hilbert space using that as our basic Gaussian function. It's the discontinuity in the normal derivative. Yeah, you see, you take the normal derivative one way plus of, they're both sort of positive. It's possible you should write it as minus. It depends on your convention. Yeah?
Okay, so Q is supposed to be this quadratic form or something completely different?
Q is a quadratic form, yes. I should say this is a quadratic form in that this is the dual. See, that's the dual space to this. So to give a thing, a map from that into... you see, the quadratic form is phi d phi by dn. So this is phi going to d phi by dn. So I'm just writing a quadratic form as an operator.
Is AS extending function to x?
Yeah. Yeah.
So it seems that
Q now depends on the choice of the
fraction
of phi. Right. Absolutely. So now that's the next point. So what if... see, this space depends on Q. But it doesn't depend too badly on Q. There's a famous theorem, which there are many versions of it, but people usually think of it as Shale's theorem, which says that if you have two rival candidates here, you ask the question, when are these isomorphic, if you have two different quadratic forms. Well, the two different quadratic forms, you can combine them into a single operator from V to V. You see, each maps V to the dual. So that will be a presumably very unbounded sort of operator from V to V. If, however, it's not too badly unbounded, if this differs from the identity by a trace class operator, then these two spaces are canonically isomorphic. So that's sort of one of the basic things. Actually, it's probably due to my famous namesake, Irving Siegel, I think. But it's attributed to lots of people, and it's sort of versions of it, many different versions of it, occur in books of quantum field theory. Now, that's very important for us for the following... except let me say, I said they're canonically isomorphic. The canonic isomorphism doesn't preserve the inner product. What it does is the canonical isomorphism that we have when this condition is satisfied, it multiplies the inner product. Well, so I'll write it like this. This becomes a determinant of Q inverse Q dashed times the inner product. You see, if Q inverse Q dashed is of the form 1 plus trace class, then it has a determinant in the naive sense, just calculatable, and this change moves the inner product by that.
So, can I just reformulate my isomorphism by dividing by the...
You could, but it wouldn't be a very good idea to do that, because we want to make... if you want to get a quantum field theory, you want to, you see, which, if you could divide by the determinant of Q, that would be fine. But of course, Q isn't the kind of thing that has a determinant. What one has to say is that we should have normalized the inner product in our space. I don't really want to go into this too much. By saying that the norm of the vacuum vector, this Gaussian thing, was 1 over the square root of the determinant of the Dirichlet problem on X with Dirichlet boundary conditions on Y. And when you do that, you find that there's a sort of Maivia-Torres property for determinants, which is due to Bugalia, Friedlander, and Kappeler or something. Which then proves that if you do that, you get exactly a field theory. So this, there is, in this situation, a canonical way of normalizing these things. Now, this is the important point. This all seems to have depended on X. So what happens if we change X? You see, we constructed this Hilbert space using X. And the important thing, then, is to look at this, what this thing is. Now, you actually have to... You see, it's made out of functions on here by multiplying the Gaussian things by linear things. So what we're actually doing is we're taking the symmetric algebra in this. You have to be careful about the duality and letting that act like that. And then we're completing that. And the way that you complete is if you have some things, these being normal derivatives, so to speak, and you want to know what the inner product of that is with something else of the same form, then the standard technology that you use in this game will tell you that you get a sum of products of terms like this. But the thing you need to know to make the inner product is that. The thing is got by applying polynomials in these things to the vacuum vector, and you need to know this in a product. In other words, we're interested in the inverse of this operator, really. That's what physicists call the Green's function, of course, for the theory.
So, question on the overall setup from a physics perspective. So it looks like what you're doing is defining a vacuum, basically.
Yeah.
And that's very dependent on the choice of the manifold X that fills in the equation. I'm not sure that that's what we always do when we choose a vacuum. Is get it from some new vacuum that results from some manifold that the facility with. So, is this
can I just say a little bit more, and that might answer your question, I think.
Okay.
Because I want to now point out how much of X it depends on.
Okay, well, what if there were no X, for
example? Yeah, I'm going to say that.
Okay.
Yeah, Y might, you might have a manifold Y which was not a boundary, it mightn't be not.
Well, or the state that you call the vector might have nothing to do with an X.
Bear with me. So here we have this operator, and we're actually interested. It's a positive operator, you easily see, and it's invertible from C infinity to C infinity. Now, what kind of operator is it? Well, it's what you call a pseudo, it's not a differential operator, but it's a first order pseudo differential operator. In other words, and what we're really interested in, as I just explained, is its inverse, which is a pseudo differential operator of order minus one. Operator is given by an integral kernel, a function of its kernel will be a function of two points on y, and of course that's what physicists call the Green's function of the theory. And it has its smooth outside the diagonal. So this is an integral operator with kernel, let's say, kernel in the operator kernel sense. Let's call it kx, which is a function on y cross y minus diagonal. And it's smooth outside the diagonal. That's the important thing. But it has some kind of singularity along the diagonal of Green's function kind. Now, the important thing is that the behavior of this on the diagonal, if you look at it, modulo smooth things on the diagonal, that's completely determined by what's called the complete symbol of this as a pseudo-differential operator. And the complete symbol of this is, of course, determined by the complete symbol of this. And that's, of course, essentially, well, it's something that's determined by the Riemannian structure of X. But it's determined locally. You see, pseudo-differential operator calculus tells you the symbol of these operators by a procedure from the symbol eventually of the Laplace operator, or Laplace operator plus m squared, on the manifold X, by a completely local thing which involves, of course, lots of derivatives and so on. So the modulo smooth functions on y cross y, this thing only depends on the germ of X along y. So all we need is a little ribbon around X, in fact only an infinitesimal ribbon, and that's where we got that number d minus 1 over 2 that I mentioned before, of the number of normal derivatives that you need. Now you see, we don't suppose y were not a boundary. Well, it doesn't really matter, because we have y sitting inside a little ribbon. We were assuming that much. Well, supposing we just look at the manifold with boundary, which cuts the thing off a bit before and a bit after the y we're interested in, then just instead of looking at the problem on some closed manifold, let's consider the Dirichlet problem with a given value here and Dirichlet conditions that end, zero at that end, or in a given value there and zero at that end, we'll still have a Neumann jump operator from solutions on one side to solutions on the other side. And when we make them vanish here, instead of making them extend all over x, although we will of course change this, we will only change it by something with a smooth kernel. That's well inside this trace class thing. It will depend on a number of normal derivatives, but we will have a space which simply depends on the local structure. So that's why that's the crucial thing. Now this is meant to explain to us why this state space, well, how this state space is local. You see, in order to construct this space, I needed a Q, but I can pick any Q I like in the class. Well, you see, supposing I take this kernel, the Green's function, which is a function on y cross y, and it's got to have definite behavior in that neighborhood. But then I can just multiply it by some smooth function and make it have support in an epsilon neighborhood so that the thing will be cut off outside a small neighborhood. So in terms of field operators, what I'm saying is I can make this vacuum vector, I can change this vacuum vector to a perfectly acceptable vacuum vector which will have the following property. You see, if I write it in physics notation, let's just think about the two-point function. If I will make a new vacuum vector psi that will have the property that phi y. So I'm now writing in terms of an operator valued distribution. This is the thing we kind of need to know. That will be k sub x, or this modified k sub x of y prime. Now we can change psi so that this will become supported in an arbitrary small neighborhood of the diagonal. And these things span, the things you get by taking psi and applying psi y's to it, they will span the Hilbert space, and I'm changing them so that they become orthogonal as soon as if you have a bunch of these things in one half separated by at least distance epsilon from a bunch in the other half, they will generate orthogonal things. Now, those of you who are familiar with the subject will explode and say, what about the Riesch-Schlieder theorem, which tells you that if you take the vacuum vector and you, or indeed any vector, and apply to it field operators localized in any little region, they generate the whole space. But you see, I was very careful about this. This Hilbert space was got by completing this symmetric algebra. Now, of course, we can apply, it's a representation of some Heisenberg group. And that Heisenberg group, of course, which came from this symplectic vector space, has operators corresponding to omega naught of y. They would be the field operators phi dot of y that we could have applied here. Now, you see, if I looked at the corresponding thing with phi dots in there, then this would give us the kernel, the inverse of this operator. And I can, if I cut off one of them, I can't cut off the other. I can't make the operator and its inverse both have their kernel supported in a small neighborhood of the identity. See, this was the kernel of the operator AX inverse. If I did these things, I'd get the kernel of AX. And that we can't have them both vanishing. That would contradict the Riesch-Schlieder theorem. But it doesn't matter, you see, so we're nearly done. So that's meant to give you the idea that in principle you can construct this space using only things, we only need to go epsilon, so to speak, beyond the region we're studying.
So your arguments, they show that the vector space can construct for different, say, x's, that they are isomorphic in a canonical way. But are you saying that you also have the canonical vacuum vector?
No. You only get a vector when you give an x. each x will have a vector jump. So now let me... you mean when I had the left-hand half and the right-hand half?
Well, don't you need to understand what I was thinking? You need to know both green functions to construct all the correlation functions from here. So, what...
You've got to be careful. If you just want to construct the space, it's spanned by these things, phi, y, span by them. But of course, if I want to know about it, I have to know how to act on it with the phi dot operators as well, of course, because I want a representation of a Heisenberg group. But as I've only got just over 5 minutes, because I started 3 minutes late, I better tell you now, jump to the crucial point. Heaven forbid. So I'm afraid all I've told you really is that we constructed this H of Y as a representation, didn't use this word, a unitary representation of the Heisenberg group of this thing sigma Y. Remember, sigma Y was this. It was omega naught plus omega d minus 1, which has an obvious skew pairing. It's a unitary representation of that generated by a certain cyclic vector which depended on this quadratic form. Now we can do that. If Y is a manifold with boundary, we can make such a group. I'm not going to be too careful about this, by just looking at the omega naughts and omega d minus 1s that vanish at the boundary, and we will still have a Heisenberg group, and we can still make a unitary representation. I'm slightly skating over a point there, but that will do for the moment. So now this is what I want to say. Supposing we now, I'll try and draw a picture. This is y1, this is y2, and this is Z, that dot. And let's call this U1 and U2 the little bits of overlap. So Y1 plus in the old notation was Y1 union U2. And similarly with 1 and 2 interchanged. So I'm going to make a space H of Y1 plus by just the way I've been talking about, in a space H of Y2 plus. And I'm going to notice the groups I want to focus on are the group which I'll call GU1, which is the Heisenberg group of sigma of U1, and similarly for U2. So these things, this is a unitary representation, because that's contained in the Heisenberg group for this. This is a representation of GU2, and this is a representation of GU1. So I now want to tell you about the so-called Kohn tensor product of representation. And I would then want to tell you that when I make this tensor product over these representations, we get the...
So these are non-degenerate.
Yeah, you have to be a little bit careful. To get a representation, you need a quadratic form. So Z is a bit... You should be careful about that, because that will depend on boundary conditions for our operators. Yeah. yeah, I mean, we're going to have to choose. I mean, I'm going to realize this as L2 on half of this space, so I'm going to need a quadratic form. The graph of that quadratic form is what we're going to interest me. So I want to tell you quickly about the contents product. Gosh, I didn't time this as well as I should have. So I want to try to avoid using the word von Neumann algebras. The example that I always find very helpful in this game is supposing you have on a manifold M, supposing we have two finite dimensional complex vector bundles, M is a smooth manifold, then we can look at the L2 sections of E and the L2 sections of F. They are two Hilbert spaces, and these are both modules over the algebra A of C infinity functions on M. Now, I'd like to have some notion of tensor product, which said that when I tensored these things over A, I got, so let's write down something that's wrong, first of all. We'd sort of like to say that this tensored with this is L2 sections of the tensor product bundle. Now, that is false. For many reasons. One reason is that if you try to do it, the product of two L2 functions would be L1, not L2. But that's not the main reason. The main reason is that this L2 space is really, if you think about it, the L2 half densities on X. You see, if you want to be able to combine two L2 things and get an L2 thing, you need to be able to divide by a volume element on X. You see, we need on M, sorry, M. Right? You see, an element of this really is a half volume form with values in E on X. They're the things which you can multiply together and integrate. So when you have two half densities and you multiply them, you get a density, not a half density. So we have to divide by a half density. So that is what Kohn explained how to do. Suppose, well, I'll tell it to you for groups, because I'll tell it to you for algebras. Let me tell it to you even for this algebra, first of all, because then it's very concrete. You see, I claimed that to get from this to this, we need to know something about the measure on M. And that's completely encoded in the particular A module, L2 of X. You see, that precisely does tell you about how to integrate over X. Now, suppose we call this thing H. It's an A module. A is commutative here, so we don't need to worry about left and right. Supposing we consider the homomorphisms of A modules from H into L2 of E, say. Well, for instance, if E were trivial, that would be the endomorphisms of L2 that commute with multiplication by functions. That's well known to be L infinity. And so this is L infinity of E, canonically. And similarly with F. Now, if you have two L infinity functions, you certainly can multiply them together, and you'll get an L infinity section of this. We don't want an L infinity section, we want an L2 section. So we have to put the measure back in, so we do this. The canonical map there, you see, if you have an L2 function on M and two L infinity sections, you can combine them and do that. Now, this is naturally a map of the tensor product over A. And we can now say, it's trivial for you to check, that if you just form this algebraic tensor product, there's a natural way to complete it, because if we take F1 tensor psi tensor G1, and we want to take its inner product with that tensor by 2 tensor G2, then the natural inner product is, well, you see, we can look at the pointwise inner product of F1 and F2, then B, so we will get F1 star, let's write it like this, F1, F2, that's an L infinity function.
E has an inner product?
These were vector bundles with inner product, yeah, I should have said that. And we can do the same thing on this side. I'll multiply them on opposite sides. It doesn't really matter. G1, G2. You form those pointwise inner products in E and F, and then you just take the inner product in H. And it's a trivial check that if you complete in that inner product, you'll get L2 of E tensor F. Now that's the general picture. Supposing we have two algebras now, but actually I'm going to have two group representations. Well, I'll say it for group representations. If we have H1, a representation, unitary representation of G1 on a Hilbert space, and H2 I'll assume that this acts on the right and this acts on the left just to make it look a bit like algebras. Then supposing I want to be able to define a notion of tensor product of these things given some gluing data. Well, supposing I give an H which is a representation of G1 cross G2, so I'll think of G1 acting on one side and G2 on the other side. So it's a unitary representation, and the two groups commute on this. So this you should think of as like L2, the L2 functions. And think of this as like think of G1 and G2 as being essentially the same, and the C infinity functions. But I really am going to stop in a minute. Then we precisely can define a tensor product which you should write like that. And the formula that I wrote over there makes good sense, providing, this is the one bit of von Neumann theory I'm really using, that these are each other's commutants on this space in a very strong sense. In other words, if you look at the operators in H which commute with G1, and the operators in H which commute with G2, then they commute. So this is meant to have the property such that this and this commute. You see, there are two algebras of operators on H. That was certainly true in the von Neumann sense. Well, doing that, we can now consider the homomorphisms of this into H1 and thing H2 and do exactly what I did there, and that will define a notion of tensor product. Now you see, in our example, this will be the space of Y1 plus, this will be the space of Y2 plus, and this will be the space of U1 union U2, the collar neighborhood, and everything just works then beautifully. The theorem here is what I was told by Anthony Wasserman is called Araki duality, which is exactly the statement that these two things are each other's commutant. When you take a manifold and divide it into two halves and look at the field operators on one side and on the other side. Really time for me to stop, so there are a lot of other things one could say, but I think that's enough. I think it's good to make you not frightened of this. I'll just say one more sentence. This algebra was made out of field operators from Heisenberg group associated to the collar neighborhood of the thing, the Z along which we cut it. One thing that's very nice is the theory should say that if we think of this codimension 2 thing, you see it has lots of possible codimension 1 things going through it. There'll be one of these algebras or groups associated to each one of those slices. And the very nice thing, which I really had hoped to say more about, is there's what is called a correspondence, which goes from unitary representations of the thing for any one of these slices to what you'd get if you rotated it through theta. And that's called in von Neumann algebra theory the Tomita-Takasaki flow, which I found extremely difficult to understand, I must say, when I read books about von Neumann algebras. But if you think of it this way, that you have a codimension 2 thing, and you're looking at its tubular neighborhood, and you look at all the codimension 1 slices through it, which, so to speak, rotate around it in a one parameter way, then each of them will have a Heisenberg group on it. And the representations of those Heisenberg groups are naturally related. And they're related just by, so to speak, propagating across this angular space-time. It's a very sort of unbounded kind of operator. And I think that's a nice way to understand this Tomita-Takasaki thing. Now I really will stop. Yes. So in other words, in order to tensor two modules, we need a bimodule across which to tensor it. That's really all I'm saying.
So you could say you have three things, one module and two modules.
Yes. But we think of the bimodule in the middle as just associated to the Z in that, in my picture. And it's used to glue together the two pieces.